The game of content creation is make 100 videos, one of them will go viral. You keep doing that until you have a sustainable career. I'm not gonna do that. I will die if I do that.
You don't like to optimize for the SEO. You wanna make what you wanna make on your own terms.
Who gives a f- with the algorithm? Anyway, go on.
Well, no. This is perfect. I fully agree.
Content creators don't know how the algorithm functions.
I wanna talk about money.
Oh,
this is your best performing video ever. Do you have any idea how much you made?
Less than you'd think. Less than you'd think. I'm not making millions of dollars doing this. I'm a working class content creator.
It's great to talk to somebody with a master's degree in media about what it means to be a creator.
Here's the number one thing I would recommend, which is...
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Today, we are speaking with Jenna Stieber, a video essayist, podcaster, and live streamer who also has a master's degree in media and culture. So she is a creator by practice and by study. She's been doing this work for 7 years, the first 4.5 as a video producer at Polygon, Vox's video game and related culture media outlet, before she went independent in late 2022. Now she's been building up her creator operations. She's got 32,000 subscribers on YouTube, and she's also writing and producing videos on contract for other media companies on the side. So, Jenna, before I let you speak, I want to make sure I have a decent grasp on everything you do, because I'm 95% sure I'm probably going to miss a few things. So there's the YouTube, two podcasts, Burnt Cookbook Party, which you're the co-host of, participant in, and then Big Game Hunger, which you are the host of, and then the contract work, the Twitch streaming, and then all the socials where you kind of distribute some of this work. Is that everything?
That's mostly it. The yada 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 part of that was all the contract work, which is probably an equal amount of work as the rest of it, but is more spread out and less reliable.
Okay, we'll get a little bit into that later. But I also want to one more situating your background question. So I always try to figure out, like, what's the chapters of somebody's career in content or whatever. And looking, we don't have to do the whole play-by-play, but my impression was that you kind of have three, and I want to know if this is right or if there's some other ones.
Okay, I like this. I feel like I'm being quizzed on my own life.
Quizzed on your own, that's what I do here. I quiz you on your own life. Sometimes I know more. Sometimes I know more. In this case, I don't know if that'll be the case. But okay, so the first chapter is your 4.5 years at Polygon, where it's your first kind of professional role. You'd worked in like instructional media for a university before. So, you had those skills of video production, video writing, et cetera. But that's where you fully learned the language of content creation and distribution in a traditional workplace focused on that. Second chapter is your first year or so of going independent, where you're kind of figuring out what that is, getting on your feet, I think, figuring out your focus. The third chapter is about the last year and a half, which I pegged around the start of your Big Game Hunger podcast in, I think, October or September 2023, which is where you've kind of established your projects and you're building them. You're not necessarily launching new things. You're focused. Is that it? Are those the three chapters? Am I missing like a prequel or a subchapter?
I think that's an acceptable way of dividing everything up. I would divide it differently.
Oh, please.
From my perspective, I would say the first chapter of in the continuity of where my career is at now, the first chapter is getting a master's degree.
Yes. Okay.
That for me, that is like the core basis. And obviously, there's lots of things that led up to that. But I think for where I'm at with my career now, the time I spent getting my master's degree, which is in video game cultures and horror media, and which I use every single day I do this work, is the core part. But not only because I was obviously getting my master's degree and studying in that, but I also learned like most of the production skills during that I use now. So operating a camera, operating a microphone, editing, using software, things like that.
Wait, did you learn those like in your classes, or were these like hobbies you were building?
No, these I had classes. Like we had production classes where we were handling much, much, much fancier equipment than I use on the daily now. But we had production classes. We had a production class where we just were hands-on with all of this stuff, which is, I think, relatively rare, but I think is kind of a fundamental thing that you should have. Like if you're studying something, you should have hands-on experience, I think, making that thing. And so I that and that's probably controversial for academics to hear.
No, I mean, I fully agree. Like, I went to a liberal arts school where I was frustrated by the lack of kind of like hands-on stuff. And then for the first few years after college, I wasn't doing anything related to what I studied. So I think there should be a focus in these programs. Was the focus, though, was it broader? Like, we're training you to enter any sort of like video production field, be it traditional Hollywood, or was it specifically more like internet platforms that you were?
Neither. It wasn't like a training situation.
Yeah.
Because we were master's degree students. The implication of our studies were that we were going to get a PhD and become professors. So like there was never an implication that you would be taking these skills into like the workforce.
Just that you understand the tools.
And that you potentially might teach a production class down the road when you're a full-blown professor. So in a way, it was job training, but it was training you to be able to train students.
Yeah, classic academia.
Yeah, basically. And then I did a year as a research assistantship while in my master's degree teaching students how to do production. So that is where, like, we took core classes about production, but then I did spend a year like organizing workshops, writing workshops, teaching kids how to use Premiere Pro and Audacity and all of these tools, which are quite significantly different now than they were then. But that was where I developed those skills. So I would say that's the first part. The second part is doing it as like a day-to-day job. Mm-hmm. So, and that bridges the role I had working at a university after grad school, and then also Polygon, even though what I was doing in those roles was often quite different, perhaps they weren't that different, but the audience was quite different.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at them, to me, like the through line is like both are basically about creating informative educational videos, right? Like your title is like instructional technologist. So you were making these media products for people to learn from, and your video essays at Polygon were much the same. You're just talking about like why the Animal Crossing gibberish language is different in America than in Japan, rather than like some, you know, more pedantic topic. I mean, maybe that's pedantic too, but some more, you know, ivory tower topic.
Yes. Yeah. And fundamentally, like the work that I was doing in both of those roles was here's a very complicated pile of information. How do I sort it in a way that is easy to understand for people who might not have like the background that I have or the experiences that I have? So the reason why I chunk those two together, although I think for people looking at my work from the outside, they seem quite different, is that fundamentally they weren't. Both of those were about going in and processing information to be accessible for other people. And so it was just both of those jobs was me curbying up as much information as I can, chewing it, digesting it, and spitting it back out as a usable media product.
Yeah. I love that. I have like my one of my pet theories of information and information processing and like distribution and doing the work you do, which the way you were talking about it reminded me of this, is like I call it my sushi theory of information, where it's like you have you know, the fisher people who go out and grab the tuna from the sea, and then they sell it to the people at the fish market, and then chefs come and buy it from there, and then those chefs use their knives to break it down, and then if you're at a nice sushi restaurant, you know, they sell it piece by piece, and the end customer just picks it up with their fingers and pops it in their mouth, and they don't have to do any of that work. And like your work is, you're like the chef, right? Like you are taking this tuna, these tunas, I don't know, into the kitchen, and you're chopping them up and processing them into like easily digestible pieces for the audience. So question in there though, what do you think of yourself as in terms of like what your skill is, what your job is? Are you a video producer? Are you like a communicator more broadly? How do you think of what you do? Hey, if you're enjoying this episode with Jenna, make sure you follow the podcast so you don't miss next week's episode. We release a new creator interview every Thursday. I appreciate your support and enjoy the rest of the episode.
Well, controversially, I do think of myself as a content creator, and I have been watching in the past year or two when people have really turned their back on the concept of a content creator. But to my argument for that phrasing is that when you listed all the things that I do, how do I sum up that? How do I sum up that I do podcasts and live stream and video essays and social media and con appearances and writing for shows? And like, how do you sum up all of that? And the answer is content creator. But if I make that not an option anymore, generally what I say is I'm either just a freelancer, which is the same problem, right? Which is that it's very ambiguous and doesn't seem to highlight any one thing because it can't. But then pedal to the metal, I usually say video essayist, because that's, I think, what people know me most for.
Yeah. Certainly, as I was researching you, that was like what stood out to me. But I really like that you did insist on calling yourself a content creator, because I feel like that's usually a topic that people I interview here dance around, especially people from like a journalist background. So my favorite question, how do you define the term creator?
Creator?
Yeah. In the content creator sense, what is that? I have a couple definitions, but I need you to give me yours first.
You know, it's a great question. Removed of the descriptor content, it is trickier. I think a creator is simply anybody who, this is going to be so dumb, is anybody who makes something. Okay. Like, right? Like, if we think of the creator, because the other touchstone I think we have for the concept of the creator is, like, God.
Yeah.
The creator of worlds.
Yeah, which is always, I mean, well, okay, let's dial it back then. Because that, I agree. It's anybody who makes something. We could get philosophical here, but put content back on it. I think when I say the word creator, it's always with the implicit content, and I kind of cut it out. But there's always the implicit content when I use the word creator here.
Well, I'll say this has just been a longer struggle in my life. Is that like if I write poetry, am I a poet? If I write a story, a novel, am I a novelist? If I make art, am I an artist? And that's, I think, a very difficult question to ask, because generally speaking, I think those concepts hold a lot of power in them that I'm not necessarily trying to take on to myself. Mm-hmm. Though I would never be like, I've written poetry, my poetry is out in the world. It's just, but yeah, I would never be like, I am a poet, that because it's just like, that's not essentially who I am. So like with content creation, for me, that's a useful term because it kind of holds at a distance all of the things that I do. And so for me, like a content creator is somebody who is making content. And I think that's the word that people really fuss with and are really struggle with, which is like, when I say content, I mean things for the internet. So if I'm like, if I'm at home and I make a little clay creature with Fimo or something and I bake it and I put it on my windowsill, I have created something. It's not content.
Not as a creator, though. Yeah.
No, it's just like a little fun art thing that I did for my own self. If I take a picture of that thing and put it on Instagram, that is content.
Yes.
So for me, the content aspect of it is very much like the digital aspect. And the content creator of it is I am making digital media for a digital audience.
This is perfect. I fully agree. The definition that I've been working with in kind of that broad sense is like anybody creating content for distribution on the internet to an audience of people beyond their immediate friends and family. When you talk about like, am I a poet? And then it gets into like that kind of capital P poet, capital C creator, capital W writer, which I think what that capital means is like the implicit word professional before it. Mm. Right. And then in that sense, it's like, in that capital C sense creator, it's somebody who is, yes, doing that content creation and distribution, but also with like a sophisticated business approach or monetization layer on top of it, where they're not just doing it for fun and like because they want the attention online and they like getting likes, right? It's like, no, I'm doing this because I want to monetize it through ad revenue, or it's going to get me a job, or whatever it is, right? Okay, cool. It's great to talk to somebody with a master's degree in media about what it means to be a creator.
Here, let me ask you a simple question. Here's why it's not a simple question, and you were wrong for answering it. Exactly.
Okay, so going back into that broadness, so you have a strong digital presence. You're on YouTube, as we discussed, Twitch, TikTok, Patreon, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, and every podcast platform. As a user, as a capital C creator using these platforms, which do you like least and which do you like most?
Ooh, I mean, Twitter is what I like least now. It's just like It's just like a tragic place. It's hard to have built up a following and put so much work into getting that following there and have it just be like decimated.
Yeah,
that's the hardest part. What do I like the most? From like a user standpoint or from a content creator standpoint?
Oh, give me one of each. Yeah.
From a user standpoint, I do really enjoy TikTok. rest in peace. I don't know when this podcast is coming out.
For the listener context, we're speaking on Wednesday, January 15th. This will be out in about 2 or 3 weeks. So by the time this comes out, something will have shaken out.
We'll all be on Red Note. Yeah. Yeah. From a user standpoint, I quite like TikTok. It's alarming in its own ways, but it is horribly addictive, but in ways that I really like. It's fun to tunnel into it and just see what sorts of bizarre delights you can find all over TikTok. But it is, like, from a content creation standpoint, a fucking miserable platform to operate on. Because you have to do so much editing in the app. You have to do captions in the app. And the captions are really important for accessibility and also, like, SEO optimization. And so having to and also the app is not good at handling videos that are over, like, 5 minutes. Yeah. And it just like slows to a halt, and the hours that I have lost on caption editing because the platform like freezes when it's time to publish videos, unspeakable.
It's such a, you put so much work into something that's consumed so quickly, if consumed at all. And then it's like, because of that, it requires that scale, which is like annoying for somebody like you, because I know that you don't like to optimize for like the SEO and the scale. You want to make what you want to make on your own terms.
It's extremely true. Yeah, I am not optimized as a human being for TikTok. Sometimes I think about making a lot more like small casual videos, and maybe if TikTok gets a stay of execution, I'll invest more in doing that. But it's just like not the kind of videos that I'm really set up to do.
This is actually a great time to talk about my favorite piece of your work that I consumed in my research, which is your second most viewed YouTube video titled "I Promise This Video Is Only 9 Minutes Long," which is technically 59 minutes and 31 seconds long, but around the like 9 minute and 30 second mark after speaking for that whole time, you get up and it's just a static shot of your office without you in it. And I thought this was a great video, so I'll explain a little bit what it is. It's kind of about the creator meta. It's about algorithms, your relationship with them specifically as a creator, and broadly more other creators. And you state why you made it and why it has this confusing title in the video. So at the time, hours-long deep dive videos were becoming really popular on YouTube. This is, I think, March 2023, around March 22nd, 2023, that you publish it. And all the more, you were only really like, I think, half a year or so into your independence, and you needed to unlock monetization on your channel. You needed, I think you need 4,000 watch hours in a 365-day period. You were at about 2,000, and you show this. You show the graph on the screen, and you ask your viewers, just, you know, finish watching this and then leave it playing in another tab. It'll be silent. Just help me out. Help me get there. And it worked. So you got those public watch hours. The video now has 113,000 views. And I checked Social Blade, the social analytics app, and it tells me that you received, in the 2 weeks directly after posting that, 8,200 new subscribers. So the video did everything you needed it to do and more. Tell me more about how you arrived at making what is a very smart and compelling piece of like metatextual content that also was very practical and pragmatic.
Well, I started with the practical and pragmatic because of how I want to make content. I'm going to pull back.
Oh, please.
So the game of content creation, and I think most entertainment jobs, is kind of a matter of who can persevere and who can hold out for like bigger and longer breaks, because I think of what we perceive a lot of success in these spaces is somebody going viral and then suddenly they've got a million subscribers, right? Mm-hmm. And that is accurate. But what we don't see is the years of buildup to getting to the point where you can be viral and being able to take advantage of that virality when it happens. So the game of content creation is one about perseverance, and it's about sticking through when you are really sad or just don't want to do it anymore or don't like what you're doing or am not finding any success. And a thing that I have noticed amongst a lot of my friends who are professional content creators is that they burn out, but they burn themselves out because they are on that grind. You know, they're making a video a day for TikTok, or they're pumping out content with very little thought and it just to get it out into the world, or even when they're pacing themselves, like they don't take breaks, you know, they don't go on vacation, they don't give themselves time and space to recuperate from the work. And even though it's work that you control, it's still work and you still need to take breaks.
Well, let me interject for a second. This reminds me of something I've heard like startup founders say, where it's like, I'm spending too much time working in the business and I need to be spending more time working on the business. And I think that's applicable here, where it's like, if you're just stuck in the grind of making that video every day, you're not going to have the time to like be strategic and plan and think about your longer term goals and like how you actually reach 100,000 subscribers or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. So the theory of content creation when I started freelancing was that it was this. The TikTok algorithm has since shifted, but this was very much the mindset, which is make 100 videos, one of them will go viral, and then you keep doing that until you have a sustainable life, right? Mm-hmm. This is, you have a sustainable career. And I was just like, I'm not going to do that. I'll die. I will die if I do that. And that it's also just fundamentally not the sorts of things I want to do. I want to sit down and research and think about my video essays and be really thoughtful mm-hmm. with the content that I'm producing. And so I don't want to, I mean, sometimes you sit down and a video essay just comes out and it's quick, fast turnaround. And that's lovely when that happens. But the nature of the work that I do is not that. It is thoughtful, and it takes a month or 2 months to get a whole video done. And those videos, the other side of this is that, yes, it's still the case where it's like hour-long YouTube videos are favored by the algorithm. And I talk about this. Oh, significantly more. It is not a little amount. It is quite a lot. And that's great for some people because, you know, their content is naturally long form, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not for me. It's like, sometimes I will click on YouTube videos and I'll be like, oh, this is an interesting head or thumb. Let's see what's in it. And they will start so far from the story that they're actually telling because they have to pad out their video to be longer. Yeah. And that annoys me. And it doesn't annoy me with those content creators. It annoys me with the algorithm of YouTube mm-hmm. because the structure of YouTube is encouraging people to do that. The structure of TikTok was privileging people who posted multiple videos a week. And so you have people who are changing the way they create their art and think about their labor because of how the algorithm on these platforms functions. And that's going to be inevitable with any content creation.
Shout out to Marshall McLuhan.
The medium is the message. It's so inherent with these algorithms. And it's one of those things where it's like, I just don't think people realize it. I don't think audiences realize the extent to which the ways that content creators make these videos is so dependent on the algorithm.
Yeah.
And the other part of that, which comes out in the video, is that content creators don't know how the algorithm functions. And you have all these people, a core part of this video was superstition and mm-hmm. the superstitions that content creators bring to their videos and how really difficult it is to fight those. But it's also, it's this two-sided sword, which is that if you have a post go viral, you want to jump on that and understand why it goes viral, because that's how you will continue to build your audience. But it's also impossible to know why some things go viral, except if you understand that the algorithm of YouTube privileges hour-long videos, then you can force it to go viral by making an hour-long video.
Well, with yours too, let's say, I mean, we can talk about thumbnails and titles for a second maybe, and how that's such an important thing to the YouTube ecosystem. With yours, part of the appeal here is that the title is, I promise this video is only 9 minutes long.
Yeah.
But you can clearly see that it's a 59-minute video. And so it's like, what's going on here? I got to check this out, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So I wanted to ask, though, like, if you... Because the algorithmic bit is like, you know, is an enemy of yours and every creator, right? It's the love, hate, often more hate. How do you think, how, I don't know if the question is, how do you think, or to what extent are you thinking about these titles and thumbnails? Or is that like a chore? You don't like that part? Tell me about that.
It's fun in its own way, because it is like a form of creativity to be thinking about, like, okay, what's going to convince people to click through
within very specific creative limits.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Which is, I think, sometimes very beneficial to creativity. It's sometimes I will go into a video knowing obviously clearly what the thumb and what the head has got to be. I've published a second video recently, Nintendo's Swimsuit Problem, which is sort of a follow-up to a video I did last year that did very well, Nintendo's Animation Problem. I've got another Nintendo's Blank Problem in the work for hopefully this summer.
And this is your best performing video ever. I think it's currently sitting at 187,000 views.
Yes. Yeah, which is exhilarating. Yeah. it's really great to see, again, because like, I did this video the way that I wanted to do it, not the way that I thought would most succeed on YouTube's algorithm. So to get that and get that success is just really vindicating.
Yeah. Well, so I want to quote something you do say. Last thing about that 9-minute video. You point out that, YouTube creators will make videos based on what they think they perform. I quote here, they're more interested in making videos on the topics. You are more interested in making videos on the topics you're interested in and then figuring out the SEO later, which is a bad strategy. So end quote. Yeah, but then actually. shortly later, you say, I would rather fail as a content creator producing work that I'm proud of and that I stand behind than submitting totally to the whims of the algorithm. Of course, I would rather succeed at what I'm doing. And then you plug your Patreon.
That's fucking funny.
But that being said, it's like, I think you clearly are, I mean, you know, you need to keep hitting these numbers consistently if you want to make that ad revenue and for this to be sustainable still. You're not necessarily out of the water yet, or frying pan, whatever. but like, it seems to me that you have a bit internalized those bits of algorithm thinking that you need to internalize, such that they're not really disrupting what you actually want to create.
It's a balance, right? Because like, I do still add keywords to my videos to get the SEO. Like, you can't fully ignore it. You can't fully divest yourself of the concern about the algorithm. I think that's true with any medium. If you're painting with watercolor, you can't just be like, I'm not going to use water. I'm not going to use any liquid. It's like, you're choosing to use a medium or use a platform to a certain extent. You have to engage with the rules of that. But I think you also need to be aware of what those rules are and decide which ones you are willing to invest in and willing not to. Like, another thing I've invested in recently is really beefing up my captions. My captions have always been functional, because it's very important to have captions on your video, again, for accessibility reasons. But recently I've been investing, because I find doing captions very frustrating. So I'm like, okay, how can I
very
find a way? It's so time intensive. It's so fussy. But it's really important. So I like sat down and was like, okay, this is an important part of the medium that I do. How can I make this enjoyable for me? And that's by just like beefing them up and spending more time like making them really descriptive, or finding ways of adding jokes in the captions that add another
layer. That aren't in the script itself.
Yeah. Huh. Making commentary about my own reactions. So,
awesome.
Yes. Yeah. And just like finding a way to make those things fun and enjoyable to me, without sacrificing my overall concern for how I want to make videos.
Yeah. So I want to get back into the craft of it all here. But for a second, I want to talk about money. And you only have to say, you don't have to disclose your tax returns, whatever, you know, only say what you're comfortable saying. But as I understand it, the way you make money right now is, it sounds like about half of it is contract work, YouTube AdSense, and Patreon. Are there other revenue streams that I don't know of?
Well, live streaming.
Live streaming.
On Twitch, live streaming is a big part of it. I get a little bit of money from the podcasts, but not as much as you would think. So please support.
Yes.
a little bit, from the podcast. A lot. Yeah, I would. Well, this is the thing, is like if you're doing content creation or really any freelancing, you need to really diversify your income sources, because at any moment, Papa Bezos can put his foot on the neck of Twitch streamers.
The Bezos say, kibosh.
Yes. Yeah. The old Bezos stomp can say, you know, I'm only giving you such and such a percentage of this now. Yeah. And because there's no union for Twitch streamers, there's no real way for us to organize and push back about it, which is such a fun thing about doing online content creation. Yes. Hey, content creators out there, we should unionize. Talk to me.
This is a topic I'm very interested in, actually. The more I do this work, the more I think about the idea of a creator, like, you know, the terms we discussed earlier, but like, that's almost irrelevant. Really what it is, this is just like a state of non-employment precarity where you're actually generating revenue for platforms, where YouTube, right, I think you get 55% of AdSense revenue and they get 45%. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's something like that. I haven't checked on what.
Do you have
the
any idea how much
is.
You made from that so-called nine minute video?
Not less than you'd think. Less than you'd think. Yeah. I don't remember offhand. I know from no, I actually haven't checked the data points on the most recent one either.
One thing though, you have on your Patreon, you make the decision, which some people do, some people don't, to disclose how much your Patreon generates. I looked last night. At the moment, there was 599. Maybe we're at 600 now. I don't know. But it said 599 patrons, and you're making $1,323 per month there on Patreon, which is pretty solid. I guess I'm curious if it was a pretty conscious decision to make that transparent and why you did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 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 Yeah. I think Patreon recommends, I don't remember what Patreon makes a recommendation one way or the other, but I don't remember which. But yeah, I do think like I often, especially on live streams, try to be very overt about like, here's how ads function. Here's how the back end looks for me as a streamer. Here's how ads revenue functions. Like all of this information is, I think, very, again, much like the 9 minute video, a lot of this information is so invisible to people who consume content, but is so important for people who make content. And so there's absolutely no reason for me to not be explicit about those sorts of things. It really only, like, hiding that information privileges the wrong sorts of people.
I agree.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's also like fundamentally at the end of the day, I'm what I have had friends use this term. I'm a working class content creator.
Yes.
It's like, I'm not Mr. Beast. I'm not making millions of dollars doing this. I would say I'm living an okay life. Yeah. Well, I make a lot less than I did at Polygon.
Yes. Question there. How long or what would it take to, let's say, replace your salary at Polygon? What would you have to do? Have you like kind of game this out in your head where it's like, oh, I would need X many YouTube subscribers, this many views per month. I would have to live stream this many, blah, 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 blah. Have you gamed that out?
No, that sounds miserable.
Not really
that
your
sounds
vibe.
Really unpleasant. No, I'm not trying to get back to where I was at Polygon. Like, I'm not necessarily, it would be great to make that money again, but like, what's more important to me is autonomy. Like the value I place on being able to control my work and control my life is more valuable to me than the salary I would make working for a place like Polygon or any of these other platforms, because they're crazy. the things that you have to do when you work for bigger corporations like that is it's a lot of it's fine, but a lot of it is just absolutely soul sucking. Mm-hmm. And because there's a larger scale, you have to like really fight for like ad sponsorships, which is just like a cornerstone of how those things like function. Like that's
many of your videos over there. Speaking of the scale, I was looking back, many of your videos that you hosted, let alone ones that you didn't host, but, you know, contributed to as a writer, or whatever, have like over a million views and millions of views. Even the scale is a different matter.
It's the views are higher, the power is higher, and all of that, but it comes at a cost.
Yeah.
And by the time by the time I was ousted from Polygon, I was so burnt out. And just like, it has taken me a long time to recover from just everything, not just with the work, but also just like New York and the pandemic and having to go through all of that. Like, I don't know. It's just a lot. And it's the double-edged sword of freelancing is that I have full autonomy now, but I also have to ensure my own structure.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day,
you also incur all the risk.
Yeah, I incur all the risks. I have to carry all of the costs as well. Hey, if you get health insurance through your job, be thankful. It's so expensive. Yeah. It's so expensive and it's so poor quality. So it's things like that where it's like I make less money and I also have significantly higher costs because I also have to like I buy most of the games that I play. Not most. I would say half. I think half the games I play on stream or something I purchase out of my own pocket and stuff like that is a tax write-off to a certain extent, but like you still have to do it. You still have to pay for it and you're still like losing that money off the
top of all of it. Is there anything that would it sounds like you much prefer overall the independent like contracting and creating lifestyle to the full-time employment lifestyle. Is there any like were you shaking your head there a little bit? Tell me more.
I'm not adverse to a full-time gig. And I respect people who are doing it. It's not unlikely that I could return to that someday.
Yeah.
If I found the right position and the work interested me, but it's just like not where I'm at right now.
Yeah. In your time there, I imagine besides, you know, financial upsides, I think probably one of the roses and thorns of working at a team like that is being part of a team and like having a writer's room and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that and like what you gained, what you learned from some of your colleagues there that you were like in the video production trenches with every day. Tell me some of what you learned from that and what you miss about being part of a production team.
Well, the thing I miss most is bouncing ideas off. Mm-hmm. Cause it's undeniably helpful to have another person to talk to be like, hey, how does this thumbnail look? How does this headline look? Yeah. Is this an interesting hook? Does this joke work? I think that's the thing I miss most is like if I'm writing a script that I knew like when I was at Polygon, if I was writing a script, I would be like, okay, I've got to make my coworkers laugh. Like that is my goal.
The barometer.
Yeah. And that made it a lot easier to like write jokes into scripts than it does to be like, I've got to make an anonymous person behind a computer laugh doing something. And it's like it's a lot more difficult to conceptualize. It's also just like coming up with pitches for videos is quite difficult. I mean, it's arguably the easiest part because you're writing yourself a big check that you then have to cash. And that's the way harder part. But even coming up with an angle on something, sometimes you'll have a nugget and you'll be like, how do I turn this into a video? How do I turn this into an essay? And being able to talk it over with other people who are in the industry and who are also really, really good at this sort of thing is just like invaluable.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like they all taught me, I mean, all of them taught me so much about different aspects of the job. I mean, I think Clayton Ashley, who's one of the hosts at Polygon and also like one of our big video editors, is so good at finding the joke in the edit. And anytime I watch his videos, I'm like, damn, Clayton, I wouldn't even have thought of putting that joke there or like. I wouldn't have even thought about cutting the footage in this way or adding this concept or this layer on top of the edit to make this joke pop out. It's just like, nobody in the business is doing it as good as Clayton. Yeah. Maybe I'm biased. But it's things like that. And like Simone is so incredible at hosting and she's so charismatic and so like open and has such like a willingness to be a goofball and vulnerable while still having so much dignity. Patrick, obviously just like an incredible joke writer and so good at like doing all of the production aspects of all the videos that we do, which is so difficult and so like hard to notice because it's so fundamental to how these videos are made.
All these details. Yeah.
Yeah. So I learned so much from all of them.
I want to talk about the hosting side for a bit. So I know you didn't host every video there, but you did host a number of them. And going back and watching some of those and then watching your current ones, and even speaking to you right now on live on the pod, you're very good at speaking for video and for this kind of format. Like, you're very clear with your words, your vocal control, you're kind of like, you're signaling a joke or your pauses. It's something that I myself am constantly trying to practice and get better at, because I often, as I have already on this recording, want to just like run away and start talking really fast and like, oh, this idea, what about that? I'm going on a tangent. So I admire your control. And I'm curious if you had done like kind of video hosting before Polygon, or how you started doing it, what makes a good video host, how you approach it.
No, I'm just charming. Was that a good, was that a useful, was I mean, that helpful for the
audience?
To be
honest though, that is a good answer. That is a good answer. Like, I think my joke is that if, in as much as I, you know, let the listeners say whether or not I'm a good host, but in as much as I am, I think it's because I'm the type of person who, like, at a party, I'll keep talking to you and I'll keep asking you questions, and you're going to walk away before I do because you're fed up with me because I keep asking you questions, right?
Yeah, that's a good stance to take as a podcast or video host. It's like, I'm going to wear you out. I'm going to defeat you in this combat, this interview battle.
Which is why I think this is a good episode, honestly. Let's get metatextual there for a second. But yeah, had you done that kind of thing before, like in the instructional videos you were doing before Polygon, were you hosting them?
Not really, but I did a lot of live workshops. Mm-hmm. Here's the truth is that I was a theater kid in high school, but I actually didn't. I did a little on stage stuff, but I did a lot of behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
Not because I didn't like the on stage stuff, but I just found the repetition of theater a little mind numbing. Mm-hmm. So I really like. This is the long and short of it is that I take for granted that I've got good screen presence, and I think everybody has good screen presence because if I can do it, surely everybody can do it, and it's not that hard. But then sometimes I will like listen to a podcast or watch a show where I'm just like, oh,
this
boy.
This person doesn't have the juice.
Yeah, they don't have the juice. And it's like, no disrespect, because they're out. People are like, they're still out there doing it. And there are other things to value about their work. Like, it's not all just about like your screen presence.
Some people are a great writer. Some people are a great host. Some people are both.
Boom.
Quick thing. You said that you were a theater kid, which I think makes a lot of sense. When I interviewed Rachel Carton, who runs the excellent LinkedIn Bio newsletter about social media managers, I asked her, she interviews tons of social media managers, and I asked her if she had seen any common thread between them, if there was just one. And she was like, they all have improv comedy backgrounds, all the best ones. And then shortly after I talked to somebody who like comes from an improv comedy background. And I mean, the answer is obvious. It's because it's about riffing and like the yes and of it all, and just like rolling with the punches. And this is like one of those internet aphorisms. I'm not sure where it came from, but like, don't kill the part of yourself that's cringe, kill the part of yourself that cringes. It's all of a piece, right? It's all of like the being willing to commit to a bit and just like iterate and come up with the next idea and joke. Like, I think that is core to, because internet content, right? One of the rules is like everything should educate, entertain, or inform. I always forget the last one, but something like that, which like, you know, so it's all entertainment. Even if it's educational, to some degree, it needs to be entertaining.
Yes. Yeah, I was on this topic. I was watching some Zooli the Witch videos. I don't know if you're familiar with their work. They're Elden Ring, FromSoft, Dark Souls creator, and their videos are very striking. They're very beautifully edited, but there's no voiceover. Mm-hmm. There's no on-screen presence, so it's all like game footage, a lot of it like modded, and then text on top of it. And they're just short little videos, and it's something like that where it's like this person, for whatever reason, didn't want to be on screen, didn't want to be visible or audible, and so they found a way to make their content in a way that plays to their strengths. And I think that is like the long and short of it is like you need to play to your strengths. So if you don't feel comfortable on screen or don't like doing it or just aren't very good at it and don't want to develop those skills, then find another way to do it. I think that's a perfectly legitimate through line. And also, here's what another weird little piece of this is that when I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently. Let me start.
Yeah.
I worked at a library for a few years, and when I got a job at the library, I had to watch this weird instructional video from like the 90s that was like, sometimes your patrons will come to you and they'll be having a bad day and they will yell at you. The flip side of this is you can never have a bad day. You always have to be cheerful and willing to help and welcoming and gentle. You're not allowed to have a bad day when you're behind the counter. And that is something that really struck with me, because it's like, on the one hand, that's kind of fucked up because librarians are people too. And if somebody yells at you, you can't, I think it's unfair to be like, you have to be gracious about it. Like, that's crazy to me. Anyway, did get yelled at quite a lot. I've never been yelled at or hit on more in a job. But taking that information forward, it's like, if you're live streaming, you have to decide, like, am I going to be kind of the live streamer who never has a bad day and is always just like, masking up? Wow, I'm here. Hey, gamers, let's do this. Or are you going to be somebody who is like willing to be vulnerable or willing to be open about like, hey, I'm really depressed right now, or that sort of thing?
Yeah.
But it is like it, that kind of mindset has been very helpful, because like, if you need to record a video because you have to put a video out, you need to like take aside all of those thoughts and doubts and worries and concerns and just let them sit on a countertop far away. And then you need to sit down and be like, wow, the only thing that matters right now is talking about Mario's nipples. Let's do it. And I think that is part of the skill, is just like being able to turn that on and off.
Compartmentalize.
Yeah. But that has its own dangers and risks. If you do it too much, then you've got like, you're bifurcating the charming parts of yourself off from your normal personality. And that's not great either.
Let's talk about podcasting for a bit. So two podcasts that you are involved with. One, you are a co-host of, it's been going since I think 2021, called Burnt Cookbook Party. It's kind of like the whole thing is I listened to part of an episode earlier, continuous narrative. I don't think it's like necessarily Dungeons and Dragons, but it's that kind of like role-playing game, right? Where you're there's like a dungeon master, you're all vocalizing it. And then you have been hosting Big Game Hunger since September 2023, which is a weekly podcast with a very riffy, improv-y premise, where kind of collectively from your audience, as we've discussed, Patreon members can give these prompts. You have a random genre, concept, and vibe, and you and the guest riff on those three things over the course of an hour, creating a concept of a video game. I guess I want to focus more on that one, because that one is wholly yours. Where did the idea come from? Why'd you start it? What do you like about doing it?
Well, longtime Polygon fans will think that I took it from Cool Games Inc., which is a short-lived Polygon podcast that had similar premise, like you were riffing game concepts, basically. Yeah. But I actually stole it from Movie Stuck, which was a somewhat longer-running movie pitch podcast, where the creators, who are all Hollywood like screenwriters trying to make it in the biz, overlapping with the Dungeons and Daddies people, for people who know that podcast, but they would have core ideas, and they would riff out like what the script would look like based on that idea. And I really love that concept, and I like playing, and I like being creative. And I do think creativity is a skill and a muscle. And if you don't use it a lot, then it does atrophy. So like, the more time you can spend just like riffing with somebody and coming up with ideas and not feeling pressured to like follow through on them, because like when you follow through on it, it suddenly becomes work. If you're just doing it for an hour and making a goofy game, that's play.
Yeah.
And so I wanted a podcast where I can play with people. And like, what does that look like? And it's like, I don't really have a lot of skill with screenplay writing, so that didn't really make sense. At the end of the day, what I like is games. Mm-hmm. And I wish games were willing to take more weird risks with their premise and the things that they do. So I was like, well, this is what I want to do. I want to spend time with other people in this industry. And I want to play with them in a creative space where we don't have to follow through on anything and it has to be video game related. So I was like, well, this is the idea. We'll get premises. Yeah. We'll riff on them for a while. We'll never make them. And that's beautiful.
I listened to some snippets of a few yesterday, and it's really fun. Like, it's a great vibe. You're really good at drawing the energy out of guests. I think, kind of like I was referring to earlier, you have a consistent energy across all your videos, on this podcast right now, et cetera. And I think you pull people into that really well as a host. So one thing we t- talked briefly about like almost an hour ago now, was that you don't put the, actually right before we started recording, you turned on your good camera, as you said. And I'd been wanting to ask about this, why you don't put the entire episodes of the podcast on YouTube. Mm. Because the reason I did that at first, when I started doing this podcast, I was like, I don't need to do that. We'll have to get a camera, et cetera. It'll make it harder. Some guests won't want to do it. Some guests will have terrible setups and that'll make the podcast look bad. But all these things I was worrying about, right? But yeah. I understand that putting a podcast on YouTube is the best way to grow it because the YouTube algorithm can serve it. One of the best ways. Oh, you kind of cringe there, so we'll have to get there. But tell me,
a fuck with the algorithm. Anyway, go on.
Well, no. That's it. So, tell me more. But also, I'm curious why you have chosen not to put it on YouTube.
Yeah, it's so many reasons. I do sometimes think to myself, yeah, I really should commit to.
Well, because like, I should say, you do publish like a minute long clip from every single episode.
Yeah, I'll slap
you've got
up
the video.
Shorts.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and we're in Riverside now. I use Riverside mm-hmm. as well. So there's a lot of like practical issues. One, not everybody I'm engaging with does podcasting content creation regularly. Like I've had quite a lot of people. I've had game devs on, I've had content creators, I've had journalists, not all of them. And it's shocking to say, not all of them have webcams or not all of them have like functional lighting setups.
I have the exact same problem. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just inevitable. Not everybody's a content creator, and God bless people who are not. I don't want to punish
God
them.
God save them.
So like there's practical aspects. And also sometimes, so if the choice came down to, I want to have you on, but you have to have your video on, I don't want people to have to make that choice.
I agree. Yeah.
Right? Like, I would rather somebody come on and feel confident and free and not be visible. And that's the other thing is, like, sometimes when you're visible, you become more self-conscious mm-hmm. about it. Whereas, like, if you're just thinking about your voice and how your voice is presenting, it's a lot more free.
It's a limiting factor. Yeah. Well, it's like what we were talking about earlier. Not everybody has trained themselves to kill the part of themselves that cringes.
Yes. And another aspect is that, like, I do edit the podcast, mm-hmm. Not very much, but normally towards the end, there's a segment where we come up with names for the podcast. And the unedited portions of those are usually pretty excruciating. So I don't know how I would put those up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Without having to do quite a considerable additional amount of work, which is exporting both the videos, importing them, cutting that up in
multiplies
a way that
multiplies the amount of time you have to spend.
Significant.
Yeah.
Hours more time doing it.
How much, wait, real quick, how much time do you think you spend across all your content, your Jenna, like not the contract stuff, but your contract, your creator endeavors, how much time do you think you spend per week on all of it?
I don't want to guess. Quite a lot.
Quite a lot.
More
than your standard 40-hour work week, once you include the playing of the video games and the streaming of the video games.
Comparable. I would say comparable.
Okay.
I'm not good about tracking my time. When I first started, I was like, I'm going to be really good about tracking my time so I know where I need to invest more and less time. But then I started doing it and I was like, this is its own task that I don't want to have to deal with, basically. It also depends because like if it's a week where Burnt Cookbook Party, because it's a bi-weekly show, so if it's a week it publishes, that's extra work there that's not there the previous week. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with Big Game Hunger, I will have like four episode recordings in a week, and then I'll go a month without doing any. Which actually is ideal for me. I think batching them like that is preferable for how I do work. So it really, Vin, if it's a day where I have like B-roll I need to edit or A-roll I need to edit for a video essay, I will almost always work like 10 hours those days mm-hmm. because you just get into it. And the flow state I experience editing videos is like, video games wish they could get me in that flow state. So it really varies. And then some, I'm
Talk
trying
about
to be
a video
better.
Game.
It's true. More video games should be like video editing. Please don't. Actually, please don't. A game I could never ever play.
Mm-hmm.
It's also weird because like the live streaming doesn't always feel like work to me because I'm like playing video games. But it is work, and it is like this is taking time on my Sunday and my Tuesday evening. So I try to compensate for that by like taking Wednesdays off. Is today Wednesday? Fuck.
It is. I'm sorry. That's my fault.
I usually try to work half days.
Yeah.
I usually try to take Wednesdays off and end up taking half days, which is, I think, a reasonable compromise.
Yeah. One more question about the podcast, though. The Big Game Hunger is part of a podcast collective company called Multitude, which I like to see because I think more, we were talking a little bit earlier about unions and creator labor. I think more creators should be part of collectives, groups like this. I don't know the exact structure and how it works. But I just really think that this kind of like collective creators working in harmony is very important to the future of this ecosystem and of creative industries generally, as you know, under kind of platform capitalism. Tell me about your experience being part of Multitude and like what this does for you as a solo creator.
Yeah, I mean, a big thing is that like I promo other shows and other shows promo me. Yeah. So if you get pulled into one Multitude podcast, it's increasing the likelihood that you'll experiment with some of the other podcasts. I think my show is kind of weird. A lot of the other shows are very like science focused, very, very like research heavy or nonfiction heavy. Mm-hmm. So I'm part of the, and then there's a couple like, they have their own actual play show, Join the Party. And then we've got my little show. But we are sort of like diversity hires in terms of like what the majority of the podcasts are.
You're the humor section.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, we're the fiction section. Yeah. But it is helpful to have like them as contacts and like being able to pull them on for guests on my show and to be able to appear on their show as guests. So that's, I will say, And I'm certain you have thoughts on this too, is that finding guests, regular guests for reoccurring shows is extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah.
Has that been your experience?
I mean, again, as like you were saying, it's hard to quantify a thing, but I think probably for every booked guest on this show, just to get them on, I spend at minimum 1 hour because it's looking for people who I think fit the general description. And then I'm looking for people who aren't too similar to people I've had on recently. I have to do the pre-research to make sure that like they would fit. I try to figure out if I think they'd be a good podcast guest, if they're, you know, if they'll be good, if it'll be chatty. I have to like compose a thoughtful email that has a little bit of like what I would talk to them about specifically. Yeah. And then I have to hope I get a reply. So it's probably at least an hour per booked guest.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it's not quite as intense. For me, it's about like 5 minutes to send off like a DM being like, hey, come on my dumb show. Like 5 minutes to write that. And then 55 minutes to get up the energy to bother somebody. In my mind, it's always like, hey, come be on my show. it inevitably, it does make me feel like a pest sometimes. Even though the response is universally people being like, yeah, I'd love to. Oh, my God. Yeah.
That's so fun.
It is fun. It's low pressure. Like, the show is designed so that people can plop in, have done no preparation or research or anything, and just riff for an hour.
Is that also the case for you? You don't really have to have done any research.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I do some research. Well, I try to get people on the show that I think are going to be fun or have an interesting angle. One of my reoccurring guests, Phil Salvador, I just had him on, and he's incredible because he's a video game archivist and historian. And he's incredible at what he does. He's part of the Video Game History Foundation, and he always brings such a mindful approach to how are we going to preserve this fake game that we aren't making. And I'm just like, that is such a unique energy. And everybody always, depending on like what their job is and where their skills are, has such a different vibe that they're bringing to the show. So I'm not quite doing as deep a dive as you clearly have,
the research, that's the 1 hour to book a guest. And then 3 hours I spent or so looking into your work after I booked you.
An incredible dedication to the work that you are doing.
Lucky to get paid to do it. Just a couple more questions. One, kind of selfishly, I'm curious about the nuts and bolts of video essay craft. And I say this with the context that, one, I'm sure many of our listeners are curious about that. Two, I want to start experimenting with making video essays for the Creator Spotlight channel later this year.
Okay.
So I've never made a video essay. I love writing essays. That's my main skill I think I bring to the newsletter. But what do I need to know? What are the nuts and bolts if I'm going to start making YouTube video essays?
Here's if you are used to writing text essays and you are trying to transfer that skill to video, here's the number one thing I would recommend, which is before you try to record, sit down and read your entire script out loud and highlight the parts that you stumble over, the words that you trip up on, the sentences that are too fucking long because you wrote it as a script and then you have to read it out loud and you're like, oh, shit, I added too many commas in this bad boy.
I'm a big, big culprit here.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And reading it out loud is such a good way of having to like grapple with the reality of a script, which is that it is a verbal product that you are writing in a text format. And you have to do some work to translate them. So for your particular skill set, that's what I would recommend. The other thing I would recommend for video essays is think through what you want to have on screen before you record. Because unless you have like a teleprompter, which is pretty advanced, I don't have a teleprompter. Yeah. That's a pretty advanced piece of tech. Then you're going to have to be thoughtful about what stuff you are saying to the camera, barreling the camera, versus what stuff is going to be B-roll or movie clips or article clips. Or if you want to do like Zooli the Witch does, which is no VO, no camera, like you have to, it's worth spending a little bit of time thinking through the aesthetic of a video before you commit to recording it. But you're probably going to fuck up a couple times.
Yeah, I understand.
Oh,
it's like with an essay. With an essay, it's like I want to know the ideas I'm grappling with before I write an essay, but I shouldn't know the conclusion. The point is to create a new conclusion. And so maybe that's how you write it, how I would write a script. But then when I'm translating it to video, it's like you do have to have the end product in mind. You do have to be working like, oh, I'm going to have like an animation here. I'm going to have a graphic here. You want to kind of, you're working towards something. You're working backwards from something in a way, rather than working towards something, which is how I write. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good way of describing it. You just have to be more thoughtful.
Is there any like particular, I don't know, specialty software, or do you just like write it in Word and then put it on the screen and talk into the camera?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I just write it in Google Docs. And then when it comes time to actually record, I make it very big on the screen. And then I basically just go line by line. I usually have picked out ahead of time the stuff that I am going to do straight to camera so that I know. And then I will just like memorize it, do it, do the VO stuff, memorize it, do it. But then I do often frequently curse myself in this way where I will have a sentence that is like a paragraph, like a big paragraph long. And then I have to decide, like, am I going to do close-ups to break this up? Am I just going to try to do it to screen? I recently recorded a video essay that'll be going live relatively soon. Actually, by the time this is out, it should have already come out. Yeah. Where I do just have an insanely long portion of like probably like a minute and a half of to the camera talking that I do and performing. And so about once a script, I have a section like that. That's just an absolute curse, but
How long does it take all in to make like a 10-minute video essay?
Like from writing to end?
Yeah. From like ideation to it's published and you're not thinking about it anymore.
1 to 2 months. But I know that's an ambiguous time frame because a lot of that is being eaten up on doing other podcasts and contract work.
The way it goes.
I would say by far the most amount of time I spend is research writing. And that's one of those things where it's like, that was much easier when I had a crew of people, because if I hit a roadblock, I could just make them read it and tell me how to move past it. But I don't have that anymore. I have to do that for myself. So, probably research writing can easily take 2 to 3 weeks.
What does research writing mean? Is it like you just going out and like writing 10 pages on all the stuff you learned about this topic, which then you'll take that and like take parts from it to write the actual script?
I always start with a thesis. I know everybody learned that in high school. It turns out it really is the best way to write an essay. So I start with a thesis, and sometimes that thesis is explicit. For like the Nintendo swimsuit problem, my thesis at the start was I'm going to investigate how Nintendo designed swimsuits. And then it turned into some other things when I had an answer to that question.
Watch the video, folks.
Watch the video, like and subscribe. Usually I sit down with, sometimes what I sit down with is like, here's a really interesting news article that I would like to know the fuller context of. So it'll be like a quick news hit about like, one that I thought was really interesting is that Whoopi Goldberg recently squashed her beef with Diablo, the Diablo devs.
Oh my God.
I'm like, what? I don't know if I'll do a video on that, but it's stuff like that where you see it and you're like, I would love to know the decade long history behind whatever.
Where it
this
tells
is.
You, it's you, you're like, tell me more. And you're like, oh, well, the viewer is going to want also say that.
Yeah. And I don't normally do just pure histories like that. So. Mm-hmm. And normally I get to a point where I'm just like, but what broader cultural context do I have to say about the fact that Whoopi Goldberg was beefing with the Diablo devs or whatever like that? Like, what does this mean for us culturally? So normally I will start with like a really core grabby concept, something that you can explain easily and straightforwardly in a short amount span of time, because that's how you make videos for YouTube. And then once I've hooked people with that, I will trick them to learn more about our culture with broader points at the end of the video.
Sugar for
where
the pill.
I wrap things up. Yeah, kind of.
No, that's good. Okay, speaking of wrapping things up, you left Polygon a little over 2 years ago. You've been doing this independent thing. What are you doing a little over 2 years from now? What does this look like? How has this evolved? Are you all in on Twitch or YouTube, whatever? What would you like this to be that you're doing now in 2 years?
That's a great question. I mean, part of me is just like, how long can I keep this going? And so my instinct is 2 years from now, I'll still be keeping this going. I mean, I would love to write more, and I am starting to write more this year, but both like more video essays for more outlets, but also just like more fiction, more like pure fiction stuff, which is not really a part of my content creation scheme at the moment.
It's the Jenna scheme, though.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Trying to think about like, I've got a good career doing what I am doing now. How can I expand my skills? Mm-hmm. Like, how can I reach more and improve the stuff that I'm doing? Because I do think it's worth sitting back on your heels sometimes and being like, okay, I just need to focus on getting good at the things that I am doing. But I do feel like I'm starting to hit a point where it's like, I want to start expanding. I want to start doing more weird stuff. And like, what does that mean? And how do I do that? It's a good question. So 2 years from now, I think I'll be doing stuff that looks very similar to what I'm doing, but hopefully with a little bit more sauce on top, a little bit more spice.
We'll find that sauce this year. Last question. What about this year? Is there any like one thing that one big goal this year, whether it's an ambitious video essay idea, whatever it is, one thing for 2025?
This is sort of a 2026 thing, but I have to work on it this year. I want to write a book for Boss Fight Books. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Very, very beautiful, very well written and researched nonfiction books on mostly like specific games. So my friend Kelsey Lewin wrote an Animal Crossing book for them last year, and I read it through. And it's incredible because Kelsey's incredible. But I'm just like, I would like to do that. But the one game I would like to do it on is Silent Hill 2, and they already have a Silent Hill 2 book.
Damn.
So I have to think about like what I would want to write for them and then pitch it, basically.
Well,
so
knock on wood. I hope it happens.
Thank you
for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Where should people go to find your work?
Oh man. Well, I mean, we've talked about so much of it. If you want to find my live streams, that's twitch.tv/the_Jenna. I also live stream on YouTube, but there's not a great way of sharing the link for that.
Oh,
so
yes.
If you follow me on Blue Sky, which is at the Jenna, no underscore, just the Jenna, then I link to both of those. I also link to all my video essays there. I'm on YouTube. You can find me there. I'm on TikTok. Maybe.
We'll see.
It's too late for you to download it and follow me now, but if you're still on there, you can find me there.
You've time traveled.
I'm just everywhere. Just find me.
Just find her, the Jenna. She's there. This has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. I will see you next week.